Okay, so today I'm going to be speaking about the ISRN series, and I'm glad that I'm going after Matt because I think you've done a great job setting up how these series, at their core, are very similar to the mega journals. And I think a lot of the defining characteristics are really the same between these two, and it's just a matter of whether you want to break them up into individual journals or run them as a single title. So I'm going to start trying to explain our motivations for getting into this. And ISRN series wasn't really our first attempt at a mega journal. And so I'll briefly go over some of the previous things that we had done and then how we got to the ISRN series. So in about 2007, right after the launch of PLOS One, we began having a lot of internal discussions about creating a journal or a series of journals that would do a number of things in a more consistent way. So what we wanted to do is to have a journal that would cover all areas of science, technology, medicine, and really have a unified editorial model. And this is one of the big benefits that we saw of the model, looking at some of the journals like the BMC series and PLOS One, was that you can really address a huge market and have a very consistent, very scalable model that can grow to be quite large. And this just isn't really possible if you have hundreds of subject-specific journals, each with their own little quirks to them. And one of the main motivations that we had in developing these new series is we decided that the peer review process and the length of the peer review process is one of the things that really could use a lot of improvement. It varies a bit field to field, but there are many fields where it's months and months and months from the time you're submitting your manuscript until you're getting a decision. And we felt that's something that really needs to change as journals move into the online world. So one of our core objectives was to have a consistently fast peer review process. And then just generally, I don't think journals have done a great job in the past of serving authors. They've been a necessary venue for authors to get their work published, but I don't think many authors would describe it as a pleasant experience going through the process of submitting an article to a journal. So we really wanted to focus on serving the authors while ensuring a rigorous peer review process and everything, but making the process as easy as possible for them and as useful for them as it can be. So as I said, our inspirations, there were really three journals that we saw as good inspirations. The BMC series was already around this time very successful, and so we were looking at it quite closely. PLOS One, which had really just started going, but it's the momentum that it had from authors in the early days really was a wake-up call, and I think it got us thinking seriously about this. And then the third journal, which I don't think gets talked about a lot, but was really important in our thinking, was Biology Direct. And although Biology Direct is not nearly at the scale of the BMC series or PLOS One, one thing that we really liked about it was the innovative editorial model that it had. And it really tried to put the author in more control over the process by allowing them to choose which of the board members to go send their paper to and have them do the evaluation. And it was sort of a non-hierarchical system where each of the editors had authority over the manuscripts that were coming into them. So it's something that we looked at during all these discussions. So our first attempt at launching a journal in this space was Scholarly Research Exchange. And the term mega journal didn't really exist back then, but this really was it. It was one journal covering all areas of science, technology, and medicine. And the editorial model was probably a bit more radical than any of the other things discussed here. The idea was that the peer review process would be carried out entirely by external peer reviewers. Editorial board members had no role. We would take each manuscript that comes in and send it to a number of external peer reviewers, and it was all open peer review, so they had to be willing to publicly stand behind their review reports. And all we would do is to ensure that the reviewers are appropriately senior. So we had metrics around their H index and their publication records. We needed to make sure they didn't have a conflict of interest with the authors. And so the idea was we would send it to a number of reviewers and they would send us their feedback. And there were star ratings associated with the paper. So based on the evaluations that were coming in, we would either go ahead and publish it or some of them would end up getting rejected. And the ones that were published would then have all of the details about who the reviewers were. It was very visible right on the article. Who reviewed this paper? What did they say about the paper? All of their comments and things like that. Unfortunately, after about 2 years of trying to make Cyrex work, we for a number of reasons, came to the conclusion that it just wasn't going to work, and that the original model that we had set up might have been too radical in a number of areas, and there were some serious problems. And they ranged across a few fields. So one of them was the scope of the journal. And today we've heard a lot of very broad scope journals, and I think PLOS One has been able to succeed quite well. But as Matt was saying, I think there is really an advantage in having journals that authors identify with their field of research. And that's something that Cyrex really didn't do. I mean, I don't think many of the authors in the STM fields would look at this title and say, that looks like an appropriate place for me to publish my work. The other problem that we saw with doing it as a single journal were more practical considerations. For example, PubMed refused to index the journal because they said that it, at least in theory, could extend well beyond biomedicine, and they would not partially cover the journal. So we felt it would be crippling to the journal if it would never be able to be indexed in PubMed because of its scope. And so that was a serious concern that we had, because clearly biomedicine was going to be an important area, and there's really no way to make it work without being in PubMed. And then the other sort of kinds of problems that we have were really around the open peer review model and the lack of editorial board members. And the hope was it would be a really smooth, simple process that we could scale easily. But what we found is it was difficult to find good reviewers who were willing to publicly give their review reports. And also, not having editorial board members sending the review requests was difficult. I think that one of the motivations for reviewers to agree to review a paper is that the person asking them to do the review is a known person in their field, and they feel some responsibility or some benefit in agreeing to those review requests. Review requests coming from a new publisher don't seem to carry as much weight. So we had a real difficult time getting enough reviewers to act quickly. And again, this was one of the goals, was to have a very fast turnaround time. So we really couldn't have a system where a paper comes in and we spend months trying to find enough good reviewers who are willing to participate in the system. So after, as I said, around 2010, we were winding down the journal, and it was tough because this was probably the most ambitious project we'd ever launched, and we really thought that it could grow to be great. And we had to accept that because of the way it was designed, we really didn't think it had a chance of succeeding going forward. But the lessons that we learned from Cyrex informed a lot of our thinking around the ISRN series. And so a few months after winding down Cyrex, we decided to take another shot at this space, but do it in a way that we felt addressed the problems that we'd faced before. So with the ISRN series, there's a number of similarities. The editorial criteria, again, it was the same, that it should just be correct research that's been well done and well presented. But we would do it as a branded series of journals. So instead of having one title that is meant to cover everything, we would launch a number of journals, but make it very clear that these are all part of a series and they're all very well branded. And we got a lot of inspiration from the BMC series for that. Again, it had a unified editorial model, which is very important for our ability to run it and let it grow to be very large. And one major difference from Cyrex was that instead of relying on external peer reviewers that we kind of find on an ad hoc basis, we decided we'll form large editorial boards of people that agree ahead of time to participate in the model. And hopefully then, if we assign them manuscripts, they've already agreed and they've already bought in, so we don't have to go through this problem with every new submission that comes in, that we have to go out and find reviewers who are willing to participate. So these were sort of the core differences that we had when we decided to make the ISRN series. So the editorial workflow, again, it's quite unique, and so I want to go through how it works. If you want to read about it in detail, it's published on every one of the ISRN series journals, so you can go and see how it works. But basically, a manuscript comes in, and we try to make the submission process as easy as possible. It's a single screen, not too many fields to fill out, and you can submit. So again, we wanted to make the service as pleasant for authors as possible. And once the manuscript comes in, our staff will check over it, make sure that it's reasonable, make sure that it's sort of in the scope and that it's correct, and run it through cross-check and all these things, make sure it's not plagiarized. And then we'll send it to the five most appropriate editorial board members. And so one of the features of these journals, as I said, is they have very large editorial boards, on average between 100 and 300 editors at the time of launch per journal. And as the journals grow, we expect that's going to have to continue scaling. So they have very, very large editorial boards. So our hope was that if you have 300 or 200 editors covering a field, you'll have editors who are experts in almost all the fields that the journal covers. So usually you would need peer reviewers because they're much closer to the submitted manuscripts than the editorial board members might be. But we felt that if you have enough editorial board members, you can do the job of peer review and really have expert reviewers who are actually editorial board members participating. So we send the manuscript to five editors that we determine are the most appropriate to handle it, based on their previous publication record. So everything that we do is very data-driven. So all the editorial board members, we know what manuscripts they have cited in all of their past work, and we look for the overlaps between the work that they've cited previously and the citations in the submitted manuscript. And from this, we're able to determine who the most appropriate editors are. We exclude anybody who's got a conflict of interest with one of the authors. So if they're at the same institute as the author, or if they've co-authored a paper in the last 3 years with any of the authors, then they'd be excluded from the process. So there's the initial phase of the review process is a 2-week period. So we'll contact the five editors, and they have 2 weeks in order to read the manuscript and then submit their evaluation. And the evaluation contains two parts. There is a binary statement that basically says, this manuscript is rigorous and provides a useful contribution, and it should be published. The second option is, this manuscript is either seriously flawed or does not provide a useful contribution to its area of research, and it should be rejected. So we're very clear about the editorial mandate, that we're not looking for to judge the impact of the work. We're really looking for rigorous, correct research. And then along with these binary options, the editors submit written comments. Now, these might be comments to the author to help them improve the manuscript, or these might be comments in the case of rejection, where they explain why they feel the manuscript should be rejected. And this is a really key part of the editorial process. And we say here, I will provide below a written evaluation of the manuscript to explain why it should not be published. So the editors are really supposed to clearly indicate why they think the manuscript shouldn't be published. At the end of this 2-week period, we look at all the feedback that's come in. So if not all of the cases do we get all five editors responding. We might get three, we might get four of the editors responding. If they unanimously say the manuscript should be accepted, it's accepted at that point. If the majority of them say it should be rejected, it's rejected at that point. But if at least half of them say it should be accepted, then we go into phase two of the process. So in phase two, each of the editors sees all the feedback from the other editors. So in this case, the editor who would be seeing this is John Doe here, number three, and he sees his own name. He doesn't know who the other editors are, but he does see all their feedback. And so if there was a concern that was found by one of the editors, they said there's a serious flaw in this manuscript, they're able to argue their case here. And so we give the editors one more week. They look over all the feedback, look back at the manuscript, and then they either confirm their previous evaluation of the manuscript, or they can update their evaluation. And if they update their evaluation, they have the same form as they had before. They can say it should be published or it should be rejected and why. Then at the end of this period, it's sort of a similar process. If the majority of the reviewer, or if the majority of the editors say the manuscript should be rejected, it's rejected. But if at least half of them say that it should be accepted, the manuscript is accepted. And the feedback is communicated to the authors in order to help them improve their manuscript. So this is what the author would see. They would see that their manuscript has been accepted on a particular date. These are what the editors have said. So they're able to then make any final little updates and then send us the final manuscript for publication. Once the manuscript has been published, one of the things that we do is we publish the name of the academic editors who recommended acceptance, but we don't publish the names of the editors who recommended rejection. And we felt that this was important because we wanted the editors to feel free to be critical and to say things in sort of an open and honest way. And so we felt that not publishing the names of the editors recommending rejection would be useful to preserve the quality of the journal. But we felt it was very important for the editors who recommended acceptance to be clearly indicated on the paper. They need to take responsibility for their recommendations. So that's sort of how the model works. And where we're at now, we launched the first journal in August of last year, and we've now launched 70 titles in the series, covering all sorts of fields. There's biomedical titles, material science, physics, mathematics. It really covers everything. And they tend to be pretty broad. I mean, some of them are as broad as oncology or otolaryngology. We're starting to experiment with a few that are smaller, more niche titles, but still they tend to be quite broad and well-defined fields. In order to make this work, we have a huge number of editors working with us. We have 11,000 editorial board members working across the collection right now. And the breakdown of these editors, we've got about 40% coming from Europe, 30% coming from North America, and 30% from the rest of the world. So it's sort of the normal places you would expect the editors to be coming from. We've had to date a little over 4,000 submissions. It's up to 4,200 or something right now across the collection. And while there are some journals that are doing better than others, there is pretty consistent success across the whole collection. Of these submissions, we've accepted just over 1,200 articles now, and which makes about a 35% acceptance rate. If you remove the papers that are still under review, we're at about a 35% acceptance rate. My personal feeling is that this is probably going to increase a bit over time as the quality of submissions increases and we start getting better submissions. I wouldn't expect it to stay as low as 35% acceptance. It'll probably move up more towards 40, maybe 50% acceptance. So we'll have to see how that develops. And we've done a pretty good job because of the very rigid time frame that we use on the editorial model. We're able to ensure not just a fast review process, but a consistently fast review process. So on average, we're at about 30 days now. We hope to get it down to under 4 weeks. And so we're working on some of the time that the paper spends internally with us in the checking process and all these things. But already, I think we're doing a really good job in getting that fast turnaround time. And in terms of indexing, I mean, it's still very early days. Many of the journals were launched only a couple months ago, so we haven't even been able to submit them. But already we've got 11 titles included in PubMed, 6 covered in Central Blatt Math, 6 in InSpec, and 16 in Chemical Abstracts. So I think the journals look like they're going to be indexed very well. Hopefully, once they've had a chance to be evaluated by Scopus and Web of Science, we hope to be able to get them included in those databases as well. But already the signs are looking pretty good. So looking forward, we do expect to continue expanding the series for a while. There's still a number of areas that we haven't addressed, and we would also like to try some more niche journals or interdisciplinary journals to see if those can also be successful. And one of the things that's nice about the series is that it's very easy for us to continue adding new titles and build on this established brand. So now when people come to the website, instead of seeing just an empty journal website, they can at least see the other content that's been published in the other ISRN journals. And I think it gives it a bit of credibility for all the new titles we're publishing. One of the concerns that we have and we're keeping a close eye on is the scalability of the editorial model. Since every paper needs to be evaluated by 5 editors, the size of the editorial boards really need to be able to cope with the submissions. And if we see the kind of growth that PLOS One has had, and we're talking about getting thousands of submissions every month, we'll need to see, are the editors willing to stay actively engaged in the process and continue doing the reviews? So far, the signs are good. So far, the editors seem to be happy to participate in the process. They're sending me home. It's the top right button. Yep. Okay. Well, anyways, that was the last slide.
We have time for questions, and I just want to say when we're finished with this, do sit tight because we'll have some information about the dinner. I think we should do
yes, it. Yes, right. We've got a few procedural things to talk about. Yeah,
procedural things. Great. So,
a couple of questions, Paul. First of all, the original series, get the neighbor. What happened to the articles in it? Do you just leave them posted?
So we have, they're still on the Hindawi website. The DOI is still resolved to them properly, and we're continuing to keep them available. So yeah, we wanted to make sure that all the material was saved.
The second question is, I was just looking at the journals. Right now, you're not charging any APC. What will be the APC once, or will it vary from journal to journal?
So it'll vary a bit journal to journal, and some of them already do charge APCs, many of them don't, and it's really just a launch phase where we feel that it's better not to put the barrier of an APC there. But we do expect that they'll be in line with our other journals, which, I mean, our average now is maybe about $800 an article, so it's on the cheaper end, but we expect it'll be about the same range.
Any questions? I actually just want to make a comment, if that's okay. I think conferences are like traditional journals in that we tend to give the positive results. I think it was really good to actually hear an example of something. This didn't work out. These are why we think it didn't work out, especially since we have so many who are experimenting and looking to move. And I think that was kind of the spirit that we wanted to have at these OWASPA conferences as well, was, you know, bring those experiences here so we know what's working and what might not be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would expect that next year when we're at the conference and we can hear back from some of the journals that we've just heard about today, there will be some great successes, and there might also be some journals that are having problems. And I think it's important to be clear about what these challenges are, and, you know, there's things that we couldn't have foreseen without going through the process. But clearly, it's much better if these mistakes don't have to be made by every other publisher. And I think we'll see. I think some of the problems that we had will also be faced by these mega journals. I think the broad scope does pose challenges. PLOS ONE has been able to overcome that, and I think you've done a great job in making the journal work. But there are certainly some challenges that I think are worth being open about.
So I have a couple of questions. So you go for 5 editorial board members to make a decision. Why 5? Why not 3, for example? And then my other question is, it looks like you have no option for a revision decision. It's either an accept or reject. So does that upset authors who are basically rejected when in a regular journal it might have been a revision decision, and now they have to come back and resubmit in some way and get a whole new evaluation?
So I'll take the second question first. I mean, as you were saying during your presentation, in these sort of mega journal models and with this editorial criteria of just correctness, the hope is that a manuscript that could be improved through revision, as long as it is in a good shape to be published and it is rigorous and well presented and everything, hopefully those major changes don't actually need to happen. But yeah, there are going to be papers that could have been accepted in a revision process, and hopefully the feedback they get from the editors is useful, and then they can go take this feedback and publish somewhere else. But no, I mean, we're not yet hearing a lot of complaints about not having a second round of review. And what was your first question?
Why 5?
Oh, yeah, why 5? So I don't know how important 5 was as a number. We wanted to send it to a reasonable number of editors. And again, we don't always hear back from all 5 of them. So we wanted to make sure that we had enough feedback from the editors to have a really useful dialogue around each paper. So we felt that by sending the paper to 5 editors, we're more likely to get good feedback from at least 3 or 4 of them. Correct, they're uncompensated. Oh, back there.
Do you keep track of editorial consistency and performance?
So this is something, as we're starting to build up more data, one of the things that we're really excited about is because we have multiple editors reviewing each paper, we can start grading metrics and figure out, is there somebody who is being really too strict and they're always saying reject when everybody else is saying accept? Or are there people on the other side that are accepting when other people are saying reject? So we don't yet have enough data, but the hope is that we'll be able to use this in order to maybe say every year take out the 5% most critical and 5% most lenient editors in order to get a more kind of standard body of editors.
I mean, I think it's fantastic that you get those editors to see each other's reviews, because often someone will make a decision on the level they think they should be at in their own mind, but by exposing them to the community of their reviewing peers, it can help them even change their own internal scales, in a way. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I think it allows the journal really to be more of a community. I mean, the editors, usually on a journal, it's a very solitary job. You do your report on your paper, but you don't really know about all the other papers that are being submitted. So one of the advantages here we see is that it is a chance for the journals to really build this consistency among all the editors. And as you said, I hope that it allow it to really get a more unified sense of quality through these discussions.
Got a question. Is there a risk that you might get 2 editors, 3, all saying yes, accept this, but when they give this comments on what the author might want to do to improve the paper, sometimes those can be contradictory. And that's often been the role of the editor to kind of sort out which of those they think it should go in. Are you seeing that? Or are you checking?
So again, I think a lot of it we feel should be left up to the author. As long as the editors are willing to put their name behind the paper and say, in the form that I read this manuscript, it is publishable, it should be published, and my name should go on it. We then feel the suggestions for improvement, to a certain degree, really up to the author. I mean, there might be things that they say, you know, I'm not going to do what the person said. And this is why the editors, if they really don't feel the manuscript in its current form can be published, they should say it should be rejected and explain why. But as long as the editors have said this manuscript could be published in its current form, there's nothing wrong with it. Maybe there are improvements that could be made. We feel those should be left up to the author to make the decision. Yeah, so we check the manuscripts again when they come in. We want to make sure it's not like a different paper they give us or something, right? I mean, it needs to be reasonable improvements within the manuscript. And so we do take a look at this once the final versions come in. But as long as it appears that there's been, I mean, they haven't changed their conclusion from this does nothing to this cures cancer, we're happy to let the authors make those sort of smaller improvements in line with what the editors asked for. What's our policy on that? Do we prevent resubmission? No, we don't. I don't think we actually do prevent resubmission. We don't explicitly encourage it, but we don't also prevent it.
Okay, that looks like a wrap on that.
Thank you.